Perm is slab bang on the geographical border between Europe and Asia. But culturally, the city's also caught between two movements, that of deep-rooted tradition and one of radical experimentation. So this week, let's take a deep dive into Perm's eclectic culture. The world-famous cultural visionary Sergei Diaghilev spent his childhood here. Then we had the author Boris Pasternak, who also lived and worked here. And the legendary composer Teodor Kurenses works here to this day. What do you think makes Perm such a powerful magnet for talented people?
I think the main reason is our people. The people, local residents, the public. Boris Pasternak had made many references to it, and Sergei Diaghilev was inspired by his environment, too. We don't live and create in a vacuum. When Teodor Kurenses conducts, the audience follows every nuance and takes a very personal interest in the performance of very modern music, say by Dmitri Kurlyansky. They don't boo, they don't rush to dismiss it, but they try to take it in and make sense of it. Even if it's not very accessible, I think that's really important. The public is very demanding. We've never wanted to be seen as hicks, you know. We've always had this ambitious vision of ourselves living in a capital of sorts. The capital of the Urals, maybe, or whatever, but not a provincial city. Urban legend has it that when the Perm Opera Theater was created over 150 years ago, the locals wanted it to host the debut performances of newly composed music. That's why Perm Opera was considered to be the lab of Soviet opera during those times. Composers would send their new music to Perm, which would be the first to appreciate it. Froth on the Daydream by Edison Denisov and Prokofiev's two-night version of War and Peace. I believe creative people really appreciate this attitude.
I'm sure you could have your pick of any theatre around the world to dance in. Why did you end up coming to Perm?
I really love the ballet in Russian. And for me, it's very special to be here because when I was a kid, I was watching videos on YouTube. And
So tell me about your first impressions of Perm. You came from sunny Brazil and you landed in Perm. What did you think?
I really like the culture, the peoples. The people so kind and cool. The city is pretty. The country is awesome. I really like the walking on the street and see the, you know, the history. I really love the history of Russia. So yeah.
As I'm sure you know, the city is very closely associated with Sergei Diaghilev, the man who introduced Russian ballet to the rest of the world. Yeah. Do you feel that his spirit of experimentation and innovation is still alive today here in the Perm Opera and Ballet Theatre?
We have like a very original repertoire here in the theatre. And there's an effect that because of Diaghilev, he did the Les Ballets Les Ballets Russes, mm-hmm. and they came to the South America on a tour. Oh. There was a ballerina called Tatiana Leskova. Uh-huh. She decided to stay in Brazil, and that's why we have like Ballet Classical in Brazil.
Ah, got you.
Yeah, if got it was you. Not Diaghilev, maybe I wasn't here.
So that's an unusual connection between Brazil and Perm.
Yeah.
We were also lucky enough to be some of the very first visitors of Perm's brand new art gallery.
Olga Vitalievna, tell me, what's so special about the Perm Art Gallery? How come it's known throughout the world?
Its collection is what makes it a part of the global cultural landscape. It's a museum that tells the story of world art from antiquity to modern days. And we tell the story with the help of top-quality masterpieces.
So let's say I was really short on time and could only see a few exhibits. Which ones would you say I definitely had to see?
If a guest in our city is really short on time, say no more than a couple of hours, mm-hmm. the place to start is, of course, the Perm Wooden Sculpture Exhibit. It is the calling card of Perm Krai.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have read my mind, because that was exactly what I was hoping to check out. Shall we go?
Perfect. Let's go there.
Now, I've been to my fair share of churches during my time in Russia, but I can honestly say I have never seen wooden sculptures quite like these. Are they purely a Perm thing? What's the story behind them?
These days, wooden sculptures are almost completely gone from churches, either in Perm Krai or elsewhere, except modern sculptures inspired by older creations. However, back in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, carved wooden sculptures were common not only in Perm, but many other regions of Russia as well. Perm was luckier than the rest, just because more of those creations survived.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we take Christianity, for example, icons are often seen as sort of abstract, sacred images, whereas in paganism, the sculptures are seen as either being living deities or being inhabited by those spirits. How did the people at the time view these wooden sculptures, both the locals and those who created them?
There are two parts to my answer. It was relatively late that these parts were colonized by the Russians, who brought Christianity with them in its Russian Orthodox form. Before the Russians, the local peoples, the Komi Permaks, the Komi Zarians, the Bashkirs, the Tatars, the Mansi, a very diverse tapestry of ethnicities, were all pagans. That's why when the Russians came and the new faith took hold, a different visual culture emerged, which borrowed some of its imagery from previous traditions. As for wooden sculpture, naturally, it reflects the features of the local population. These are sometimes described as portrait-like, though they're not meant to resemble specific individuals, but rather certain traits: high cheekbones, large, deep-set dark eyes, a slightly elongated lower face, and so on. At times, the features appear more mongoloid, reflecting the ethnic intermingling that gave rise to striking and distinctive physical types.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there any specific rules that they had to follow when creating these wooden sculptures? Did they have to use a specific type of wood, paint, mm-hmm. posture, mm-hmm. facial expressions? I see a lot of the Christ figures, for example, are set like that. Mm-hmm. What's the reason for that?
Our collection includes 17 sculptures of the seated Savior, and no two are alike. The more precise name of this iconographic type is Christ in the Dungeon, that is, Christ when he was in prison before his execution. Scholars still debate which term for this iconography is the most accurate. But by the time the phenomenon of religious wooden sculpture emerged in Perm region, this image was already well established. It existed in Catholic art and in Russian icon painting alike. In three-dimensional sculptural form, however, it acquires distinctive features simply by virtue of its volume. Typically, Christ is shown seated with his knees bent. Sometimes the legs are extended slightly forward and crossed. The hands may be folded over the knees. This is a blending of two separate traditions. In this variant, where Christ sits with his right hand raised up, the gesture signifies acceptance of his fate. It conveys humility as well as spiritual suffering and compassion for those who know not what they do. The hand lifted toward the cheek has rich, multi-layered symbolism. Among common folk, however, there were simpler explanations. Christ was simply covering a fly. Yes, in some versions, Christ raises his hand to his chest to cover a fly. His tormentors arrive, see him covering something on his body, mistake it for the mark of a wound inflicted by someone else, and leave empty-handed. There has always been an abundance of such naive interpretations. The same applies to icons. Flat, seemingly abstract images, as you mentioned, although in fact they're not abstract at all. For a medieval person, they were very clear and straightforward. It is only for modern viewer that icon art appears elitist. In the Middle Ages and the early modern period, it functioned as an accessible Bible for the illiterate.
But did they use a special type of wood or paint to create these sculptures?
All the sculptures are carved from local wood. There was no strict canon regarding materials. There is linden, various conifers such as spruce, sometimes larch, and occasionally birch. As a rule, the sculptures are composite constructions. It's nearly impossible to find a tree trunk large enough to carve them from a single block. Structurally, they're assembled from separate pieces, sometimes secured internally with nails. The way the sculpture is presented here is the way it was originally made by the craftsmen. Some sculptures are coated with chalk primer, called levkas, similar to the primers applied to icons before the painting is done. They were then painted most often with tempera or sometimes with oils. So these works have traces both of icon-making practices, with their layered approach, and of conventional painting techniques.
Well, the Russian media to this day still describe Perm as a cultural laboratory. Why do you think that is? Is it the people? What do you think the city offers that the likes of Moscow and Petersburg don't?
I don't think it's about more things being allowed here, although it could be a factor. There's a certain expectation and ambition. We don't want to be stuck in the Permian period, you know, when we dig up something permanently fixed in time. Perm residents today, just like their ancestors 200 or 300 years ago, want to grow spiritually and be the agents of this growth. The majority of the theater-going public in Perm are science and engineering professionals. They're inventors. They have this urge to improve, to seek new solutions, design new mechanisms, and figure out new ways to solve old problems. It's in their DNA. Perm is a frontier city, if you will. It sits on the border between Kushtun culture and Komi-Permiak culture, between Christianity and Islam, between Central Russia and the Urals region and beyond. And a frontier always generates creative energies.
So would you say it's something that's in the DNA of the people here, this spirit of innovation and experimentation?
Yes, I think it's in their DNA.
Street art today in Perm, is it purely decorative? Or does it carry with it some sort of statement or message?
I'd say the truth lies somewhere in the middle, but first and foremost, this is a statement. We're big patriots of our city and our region, and through all our projects, we try to communicate the value of this place, its identity and its cultural code. Perm has an incredibly rich history. Even this mural is about the Perm region. You see the river, the layers of mineral deposits that are extracted here in the region and in the city itself. It's all about how an artist processes that material internally and through their own style conveys the diversity of Perm's culture. So yes, it's a statement, but it's also decorative. It really does make the walls stand out. There's more and more of this kind of work appearing around the city now, in all kinds of styles, and it genuinely makes it more beautiful. It also deters vandalism. Once a wall has something painted on it, graffiti artists usually leave it alone.
You created this mural of Kudim Osh, who's a hero. Andre, can you tell me who he is exactly and why does he have such a commanding position in the town of Perm?
The theme for the festival where I created the mural was Perm folklore. In my view, one of the most striking figures, and still underrated, I think, is the Perm legendary hero Kudim Osh from the lands of Komi Permyak. There are countless legends about him, along with some intriguing historical facts. Some stories say he was half bear, half man. Others claim his father was a bear and his mother was a witch. I actually depicted her in the mural as an owl perched on the top of a pine tree. But beyond the myths, there are also some fascinating details. The image of the Bagatyr, the mighty Russian hero. Yes, the archetypal Russian man, invulnerable, powerful, robust. In reality, his father was a warrior, but Kudim Osh himself didn't inherit that path. He was more of a trader, a traveler. He brought many things to Perm, seemingly simple things, but transformative. He introduced grain crops and taught local people how to cultivate bread. He is even credited with building the first boats in the region, replacing rafts.
A man of many talents.
Some authors compare his achievements to those of Peter the Great. You've certainly heard of him. He was also said to have lived a very long life here in Perm, supposedly around 150 years. There's not much evidence, but we believe it, so we don't dismiss it as the stuff of legends. Naturally, I portrayed this mighty hero in my own artistic style, though it still incorporates certain elements associated with that earlier time. And since the bear is one of his main symbols, I included it in the mural as well.
Now, I have it on good authority, Andre, that this is the tallest mural in Perm. How do you even go about creating such a large work of art?
Yes, it's true. This is the tallest mural in the Urals. I only found that out after it was done. It was difficult, that's for sure. First of all, it's a massive thing. The drawing had to be transferred using a projector, the kind you'd find in a movie theater. Because of the height, I had to divide the composition into sections, projecting only the outlines at first without color. That required a certain distance, an entire night of work and several assistants. Otherwise, I was prepared. I often work with facades and large-scale paintings, but the biggest factor was the wind. This place has constant strong winds. I was working from a construction cradle that only moves vertically, up and down. At times, the wind would swing me 5 or 6 meters to the side. I'd have to cling on and wait until I drifted back. Those first 2 or 3 days were pretty scary. And after that, I just got used to it.
Sounds like you risked your life for this.
At some point, you don't care, because the main goal is to recreate the image exactly as I first saw it in my mind when it was just a small sketch. The hardest part is bringing that vision to life on a massive scale and making sure it still reads clearly. That's the idea behind muralism in general, and behind my mural in particular.
I know that several of your works pay tribute to Perm's cultural heritage. Is it important for you to share the city's story with the local people and the rest of the world?
Yes, it is important to me. Here in Perm, it's a clear example of how visitors can come and discover our culture. But I always try to bring my own culture to other regions. Sometimes I'll travel to somewhere, say, Kamchatka, and they say, paint us something like we have here in Kamchatka. And I do that. But often, during the sketch selection process, I propose elements of my own culture as a way of sharing it.
Well, Andrei, thank you for telling me all about the Perm culture and your work today as well.
Thank you for taking an interest in my art.
Okay, finally, an abstract question for you, Ala. Say that Perm were a person. What character would you give that person? How would you describe them?
I myself wasn't born in Perm. My parents moved here after graduating from the conservatory. So studying the features of Perm's face is something I'm trying to do myself. The people here are tough, for sure. They can be exacting and skeptical. They like to criticize a lot and are never immediately pleased, but they are serious thinkers and they set much store by sincerity. Not the kind of gregarious sincerity you have in the South, where they go, hey, brother, come here. That kind of stuff. No, the people here appreciate eye contact, and if they think you're one of their own, if you're trustworthy, everything becomes possible.
Well, Ala, thank you very much for telling me all about the spirit of innovation, experimentation, and the culture here in Perm itself. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest in Perm Cry.